Chapter 16. Although I carry out my work with respect and a sense of loving humanity, I do so with an essential scientific detachment. A few years into my job, I did think I had become rather good at leaving detachment at the door of our house, so I was a bit disappointed at Jen's hints that I was applying it to family life. That the jovial, loving husband I'd thought myself to be was instead a dour and preoccupied workaholic. Moi? Surely not. So I was caught stabbing the Sunday roast with a series of different knives from different angles while I waited for the oven to warm up. So what? I was convinced I could deduce the exact size and shape of a knife from the injuries inflicted by it, and there was no lump of meat so like a human lump of meat as a joint of beef. I'd be a fool not to carry out a little experimentation when I was waiting to shove the beef into the oven, wouldn't I? You mean, Daddy, that you pretended our lunch was a human person? Asked Anna, putting down her knife and fork. A human person being killed? Don't be silly. It obviously isn't a human person, I said, tucking into my beef briskly. My meat's full of stab marks, added Chris. Look. I had expected greater loyalty from the other male in the family. I glowered at him over the joint, but it was too late. By now everyone had put down their cutlery. Our lives were absurdly busy. I tried to get back from work most evenings in time to take over childcare from the nanny and cook the dinner. Jen was now working junior doctor hours. Forget synchronizing diaries, it was a matter of cobbling each week together. Then, when we were out one day, our house burned down. Not entirely, but enough to mean we had to move out. The fire was either started by an electrical fault, by an aggrieved offender against whom I'd given evidence, as the police suspected, or it was my fault. We never did find out which, but Jen tended to favour the last of these possibilities. We stayed with friends, we rented accommodation, we fussed over builders, we agonised over whether to sell the house as a burnt-out shell and buy another, or restore it and return. I tried not to regard the house, with its intact structure and black, smoky, largely missing interior, as symbolic of my marriage, but even I could see that the difficulties and pressures of living in a series of temporary homes were not making that marriage any smoother. What a relief when the holidays arrived. Kids and dogs were all piled into the car, and we progressed slowly north up the motorway. Off to the Isle of Man, where my generous in-laws were ready with food, love, parties, towels for the beach, tea time for the children, whiskey and sodas for the evening. Austin and Maggie were becoming charming caricatures of themselves. He, the solid colonial, she with groaning wardrobes of glamorous dresses, the pair of them with more friends than you could fit in the house, perhaps fit on the island. Jen and I called a truce during those holidays, and tension between us evaporated as Jen's good parents worked hard to ease all our burdens. I was only caught once in the kitchen sticking Maggie's knives into the beef, and Maggie was intrigued rather than angry. Then, happy and refreshed, with brown giggling children in the back seat, buckets of seashells wedged between flip-flops, and dogs thumping tails full of sand, we returned to London, looking very different from the tight-jawed individuals who had left. It took about 2 days for us to revert, and even before we became those busy parents and doctors again, the tensions returned. We didn't have rows. We had seething, and we had silences. I was probably trying to make up for a seething or a silence, the cause of which I forget, when I bought Jen a new dress and flourished tickets for the opera, Tosca. I was really keen to see it. I knew it would be my sort of evening because a colleague had described Tosca as a wonderfully forensic opera. Such an evening out was very extravagant by our standards, and we certainly looked forward to it, the only possible fly in the ointment being that I was on call and hadn't been able to swap this shift with someone else. Sure enough, the babysitter had already arrived, and we were in the bedroom getting ready when the phone rang. Jen watched me answer. Pam here. Tough, no nonsense. Organiser of disorganised pathologists, Pam. That could only mean one thing. Jen saw my face and her eyes narrowed. Right, Pam said, her habitual way of starting a conversation. You've had a call out. Shocking case. Whole family shot dead in their beds. Probably last night, but not found until this afternoon. The father survived, just. Badly wounded, now in hospital. That sounded like the kind of case I should go to right away, and my face must have said so. Jen saw it and turned her back on me. The lovely new dress was still on its hanger. Instead of lifting it off, she sadly opened the cupboard and put it away. Where? I asked Pam. I'll tell you where, but you're not going tonight. I inhaled sharply. I always went immediately. You got Jen that dress and you bought those tickets and there's no way you're cancelling that. Pam always knew everything. But go running after some homicide now and she'll never speak to you again. It can wait. This was enough to give any forensic pathologist palpitations. The point about rushing to a crime scene is that, quite apart from police urgency and the relatives' need to know, we're at our best when the body's early processes, such as cooling and rigour, can offer us the most accurate indicators of time of death. I said, Pam, I think I'll have to go because I've already said you're not going tonight, and if you're worried about time of death, stop. The police already know. The father left a suicide note, and the neighbours heard some bangs and said it was about 1 a.m. Anyway, it happened last night, and the police have been working on it this afternoon. With three bodies to process and all the other stuff, they won't need you until tomorrow. But the dead aren't going anywhere, and the husband's in hospital, so there's no rush. There was always a rush. Just get there at 8 tomorrow morning, it's all arranged. But, Dick, you're not arguing with me, are you? Nope. No one argued with Pam. So we went to the opera, and Jen wore the dress, and it was a lovely evening, except that somehow the family shot in their beds went to the opera with us. I was trying not to think about them, but I did. Which body would I start with? How bad were the father's wounds? Had he killed them all and intended to kill himself, but bottled it at the last minute? Or just misjudged the shot? Or had there been a mad, masked intruder who had made him kill the family and write a suicide note? In which case, why had the father been spared? I didn't go to the call, but it had been obvious to Jen that I was more than willing to, and that Pam had stopped me. Jen was monosyllabic while we were out. We returned home and waited until the babysitter had left, and then we had the row. Well, Jen rowed. In the face of her anger, I was very, very quiet, like a small mammal crouching in the hedge until the bird of prey flies over. I had somehow managed to ruin our wonderful evening out. I can't stand it, Jen said, when you go quiet and moody on me. I'm upset. Why don't you reach out to me? Comfort me. Because? Is that why you work with corpses, Dick? Now, just a minute. Because they won't notice when you act completely detached around them. Touché. Although Jen blamed the early death of my mother for my ability to withdraw as soon as the going got tough, I suspected it was more likely because of my father's volcanic tempers. I had depended on him totally, and mostly he created a secure, loving world, which was rocked from time to time by his outbursts. The long-term result is that I barely ever allow myself to loosen the lid of my own volcano. Of course, I do feel angry or sad or disappointed sometimes, but instead of displaying it, I retreat into silence. I seldom argue and never shout. Well, I did once, perhaps around this time or a little earlier. Many years later, my daughter said at her wedding that she could remember me losing my temper on only one occasion in her entire life. New suit, children, bath, water pistol. I felt no shame. In fact, I'm quite pleased I managed to lose my temper at all. A romantic opera evening wasn't the success I'd hoped for, so I thought I might as well scuttle over to the homicide scene right away. But one look at Jen's face told me this could be grounds for divorce, so I contained myself. However, I was up at 6:30 the next morning, Saturday, getting ready to leave for the murdered family's house. Jen did not wake up, or seemed not to anyway. I arrived at 8 a.m. as instructed by Pam. This was going to be a long, long day. There were still plenty of police around, but surprisingly few reporters. Probably they'd been and gone. There isn't a homicide, especially a multiple homicide, that is so ghastly it goes unreported. In my experience, the worse the better as far as journalists are concerned. Even today, Jack the Ripper's ugly murders continue to make headlines. Only the details of some sexual murders seem to evade the press, although that is probably more to do with information being withheld than a sense of decency towards the bereaved. When I entered the house of the murdered family, it retained that silence of death I now knew so well, although police officers were still busy and people were chatting. What I found inside was a ghastly parody of the family homes up and down the land that were waking up to a normal Saturday morning. It was in very good order. There was none of the chaos which can characterize murder scenes. No empty bottles of beer and vodka, no filthy carpets, no decaying kitchens, no blood-filled bathrooms. This was a family which cooked and ate well and took care of themselves and each other. The teenage daughter's bedroom was clean and pretty, with homework completed and put away by her school bag. Her clothes were neatly folded. She lay in the bed in her shiny pajamas. A single bullet had passed straight through her head. In the next room, her older brother lay on his back, shot through the centre of his forehead from about 6 inches, apparently as he slept. There were no signs of a struggle or any other disturbance. Their mother, a pretty, dark-haired woman, lay on the right-hand side of the marital bed, hands together as if in prayer beneath her right cheek, peaceful. The bullet had smashed through her left forehead and a trickle of dried blood ran down her face. "No doubt about it, the father did it," said the socko. "How bad are his injuries?" I asked. The officer had been there much of the night and looked grey-faced and dishevelled. "Well, apparently he's not going to die." I wondered if the father had wanted to die, or if merely injuring himself really had been his intention. He'd been very certain about the previous 3 shots. Had he also shot himself in the head? If so, it would have been hard to be sure of avoiding death. Strange. I discussed with the photographer what pictures he had taken, and then told him what more I needed. I took one final look at the mother and both the children before agreeing with the coroner's officer that these 3 tragic bodies could be removed to the mortuary. Once they had gone, and because there were no more fingerprints to be taken, I could wander around the scene and look at it in more detail. At that time, no one had heard of DNA evidence, and forensic science certainly was not as advanced as it is today. The result was behaviour at the scene of a crime that would nowadays be regarded as worse than casual. So, while we were always quite careful not to touch anything other than the body, if a fingerprint taken turned out to belong to a pathologist, then the only result was that we had to buy the socko a bottle of whiskey. The postmortems of the family were straightforward. Here, after all, were 3 healthy people, all of whom had been shot once through the head. Yet it was a most haunting case. That house, with its silent, ordered rooms and incongruous bodies, certainly stayed with me. Its darkness followed me home, and I could not quite eliminate it as I closed the door behind me. It was late afternoon, and the children were running riotously through the house. The sight of them, laughing and pink-faced, so alive, made me absurdly happy. I went straight to the desk where Jen was bending over her books and put my arms around her and apologized for being so wrapped up in my work and for being cold and detached at home. Knowing nothing could be worse than the cold detachment of the family whose bodies I had just examined, I whispered in her ear a promise that I would try harder to be a more loving, open, emotional husband. It later emerged that the father who had shot his own family had not shot himself in the head. His injuries were not life-threatening. As soon as he was discharged from hospital, he was sent straight to a psychiatric unit. A police officer I met later, on another case, told me that it had been easy for the father's defence team to convince everyone that he was deranged enough to be charged with manslaughter with diminished responsibility. Manslaughter usually results in a lighter sentence than murder, so of course it is preferred by defence teams. And diminished responsibility was often in those days achievable. Later, the 2010 law reforms tightened the definition of diminished responsibility, so that it now can be applied only to those with a recognised medical condition. But for many years before these reforms, the plea of diminished responsibility was fair game for defence counsel, and I fear was often abused. In this particular case, however, it did not occur to me, or apparently anyone, that the father could be anything but mad. You'd have to be completely crazy to shoot your family, wouldn't you? I assumed the case would end there, but in forensic medicine, despite the fact that patients are certainly dead, cases have a habit of coming back to life. Some months later, I was called to give evidence at the father's trial. I was amazed to find that he had been charged, not with manslaughter after all, but with the murder of his family. The police officer told me quietly that the father had begun a relationship with a female resident in the psychiatric hospital. He had confided to his new lover that he was just pretending to be mad, and that in fact family life had been getting on his nerves. He had simply shot his family because he was tired of them. You might think this is clear evidence of psychiatric disorder, but when the lover passed her information on to the authorities, they immediately initiated in-depth interviews, and the result was that he was judged to be of sound mind. The charges were changed to murder. The father was found guilty and given a life sentence. The terrible scene of family destruction in the heart of that house of apparent harmony had been not the result of madness, but cold-blooded, intentional, and planned homicide. His trial reminded me of my resolution to be a more caring husband. I don't think anyone, least of all my children, ever accused me of being an uncaring father. I got them ready in the mornings, and as soon as I was home from work, I was busy with reading, cooking, homework, games, bedtime, but I was definitely slipping in the husband department. Jen wanted a demonstrative, loving husband. I thought I was demonstrating my love by taking on the lion's share of responsibility for home and childcare during her long training. However, when I thought about the father who had just been jailed, I realized that he might have appeared to take care of his family adequately, while actually, silently planning their murders. I realized that it was, in fact, perfectly possible to participate fully in family life while one's mind was somewhere else completely. Did I do the same thing? Was I thinking about work too much while playing the good father? Could this be the reason Jen was complaining? Was she in fact asking for more loving, focused engagement? I pondered, but I did nothing. We were back to a busyness which seemed to preclude any loving engagement. One of us was always just about to leave for work. And if we were both home, there were 1,000 topics which required our attention. The children and their schoolwork, difficulties at work, the house repairs. I wondered how I was supposed to fit love into all this. Should I write it in my diary? Staff meeting 5 p.m., love 7 p.m.? And what was I supposed to do? Bring home flowers? Light candles at meal times? I would have liked to ask other men how they managed to make warmth, humour, and this love business a part of their everyday married lives. But such a conversation would not have been acceptable in work circles. In fact, it would have been impossible. We talked about homicide, not love. And so I blundered on.